This is the takeaway for Wednesday, May 17th, 2017.
The president looks at the FBI director, they're one-on-one in the Oval Office, and he says, I hope you can see your way clear of letting this go, to letting Mike Flynn go.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Words from a memo read to a reporter. If true, could they bring down a president? A week ago, people were saying that FBI Director James Comey could never have been fired in the old days of J. Edgar Hoover. Old Untouchable himself ran the FBI like an empire. One way he did that was that he had files and memos and pictures of all kinds of alleged misconduct by people in Washington, D.C. who could challenge him, from cabinet members to senators to reporters. Hoover had the goods. Well, now it appears that James Comey has taken a page from the Hoover manual, and suddenly the White House looks a lot more vulnerable than it did 24 hours ago. The New York Times alleges President Trump, back in February, asked then-FBI Director James Comey to let go of the probe into National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and Russian ties. Comey made written notes of those conversations, which have now come to light. What did the president want Comey to do, and what did he do when he didn't get it? Could this constitute a case against the White House? Are we looking at a case of obstruction of justice regarding an investigation into Russian involvement in the U.S. government? That's our focus. We begin with the Comey memos themselves, denied by the White House, it should be noted. Michael Schmidt is the reporter for The Times that broke this story. He spoke to that source. It was Schmidt's voice you heard at the beginning of the program.
What he was doing was creating a paper trail and documenting the behavior that he was concerned about that the president was doing, and that Mr. Comey thought could jeopardize the FBI and its independent investigation into connections between Mr. Trump's associates in Russia.
The assumption being that the president has no business telling the FBI whether to investigate or not to investigate any particular individual or subject, right?
The FBI is part of the Justice Department, which is obviously in the executive branch, but it sort of has this odd existence where it's supposed to be independent. It's supposed to basically be off on its own to follow the facts. Presidents have struggled to understand that in the past. With President Nixon, there were issues with him meddling with the FBI. But for the FBI, they really pride themselves on not taking direction from anyone and simply rooting themselves in what the evidence is.
And in the memo that was apparently read to you, what language particularly comes close to the president attempting to actually shut down an investigation or try to really derail an investigation that was already public and ongoing?
The president looks at the FBI director, they're one-on-one in the Oval Office, and he says, I hope you can see your way clear of letting this go, to letting Mike Flynn go. He's a good guy. I hope you can let this go. The basic message there being that the president didn't think there was any reason for the FBI to be investigating the National Security Advisor who had just been fired.
Now, how concerned was Comey about this particular attitude of the president in these meetings that took place in February?
I think he was deeply concerned. Look, Jim Comey has taken a lot of criticism from the left and the right, and from folks inside of the Justice Department. He has a lot of critics, but Comey really prides himself on his independence. And anything that would jeopardize that or would raise questions about that or the independence of the FBI, I think Comey would react very, very strongly to, and in this case did.
You know, this looks suspiciously like Comey's insurance policy, that, you know, he was trying to protect himself should he get fired. Do you know anything about the time of these memos, when they were actually created? Is there any way for you to know
that contemporaneous to every phone call and every meeting that Mr. Comey had with the president, he created a memo to document it. Some people would say that this is an insurance policy to cover yourself. Other people would say that this is the right thing to do when they see behavior that they are curious about. We still don't know everything. Mr. Comey hasn't spoken publicly about this. And my guess is that he'll be summoned up to Capitol Hill and we will be hearing from him in some sort of testimony in the weeks or months that come.
And according to your sourcing, is this information that Comey wanted to get out?
I don't know whether Comey has made a decision about whether he wants to release these memos publicly or how they're going to handle that. I think that for Comey's defenders, they believe that the most amount of information that comes out, the better it will look for Comey, because they think that there is a lot here that he's documented, and they believe the facts are on his side.
Michael Schmidt, reporter for The Times, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So from the existence of memos to the wheels in government that begin to turn in cases like this, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Jason Chaffetz, has made the first move, asking for all relevant Comey documents. Arizona Senator John McCain reportedly said that scandals around the Trump administration right now were reaching a Watergate size and scale. Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who knows how the oversight machine works on Capitol Hill. Byron, where do we go from here?
Well, certainly Congress is going to want to have a look at these reported memos. If they exist as reported, there are several congressional committees that might have jurisdiction, including the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, as well as the two intelligence panels that are investigating all the issues surrounding alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election, which certainly includes issues related to Michael Flynn. So these panels are all going to want to have a look at documentation that may or may not exist around Director Comey's conversations with the president. Beyond that, there's just a general clamor on Capitol Hill for answers around the swirl of sort of controversy that surrounds this White House, and that includes any alleged tapes that might exist, as the president has hinted himself, as well as other documents pertaining to this general situation.
In the oversight mechanisms on Capitol Hill, Representative Chaffetz has asked for certain things. Describe what this letter is asking for and whether Congress actually has the authority to ask for it.
So Congress ultimately does have subpoena power. On the other hand, the executive branch has often asserted what is called executive privilege to avoid giving documents over to Congress. So Mr. Chaffetz, who is the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, which has broad jurisdiction over uncovering waste, fraud, and abuse across the federal government, is asking for a wide variety of documents from the FBI related to communication with Mr. Trump. And this is the same committee that asked for a similar set of documents during the Obama administration related to a gun-running scandal down in the southwestern United States called the Fast and the Furious that ultimately resulted in a claim of executive privilege. So this is something that Congress and the White House often fight over, whether to provide documents and whether Congress should have access and oversight over certain aspects of the executive branch's functioning.
If the president, and he's said as much in some public statements, thought that firing James Comey was going to get the government to move on and get back to the business of tax reform, say, and health care, exactly the opposite has occurred. And not only the opposite has occurred, but we're looking now at the triggers that have been pulled here at months and months of investigations. Yes?
That's right. And a lot of this is self-inflicted by the White House, from the tweet that the president sent out about alleged tapes to the handling of the firing itself, including the timing. And now we have reports of the president raising issues of sensitive investigations into both himself and close associates of his directly with the FBI director, which is sort of an unprecedented and extraordinary interference in the FBI's traditional independence. And so this is a major issue, and it's only going to grow more controversial. There's only going to be a bigger firestorm on Capitol Hill as Congress sort of clamors for documents, interviews with witnesses, and public hearings about exactly what's happening. This isn't something that's going to go away quickly for the president. This is a major firestorm and a political crisis all wrapped in one.
Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now the question, is the president in real trouble here? Does this amount to impeachable offenses, high crimes and misdemeanors, as the Constitution specifies? Our friend Jeffrey Rosen is president of the National Constitution Center and professor of law at George Washington University. We asked him, at the very least, should Donald Trump get himself a good lawyer?
The endgame of this is not a criminal prosecution, but impeachment, because most scholars think that you have to impeach a president before you can criminally prosecute him. but the possibility of either a congressional investigation or a special prosecutor revealing evidence of obstruction of justice became greater yesterday in light of at least the possibility that Trump fired Comey with the intent of shutting down the Russia investigation. The definition of obstruction of justice is broad. You have to obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. And there's a mental state requirement. You have to have intended to shut down the investigation, and that has to be the primary motive. It can't just be one of several motives. So it's not an open and shut case in the easiest of circumstances. And since there's unlikely to be a courtroom to adjudicate the president's mental state, that may make it easier for him to deny and to avoid liability. But it sure looks bad. And the fact that Republicans, as well as Democrats, are wondering whether the firing had the intention of shutting down the investigation suggests, as several law professors have indicated this morning, that Trump should be getting a very good personal lawyer.
So the lack of a political majority here to move forward makes a lot of what we're discussing about the specifics of intent, that obstruction of justice, relatively moot. If Congress doesn't want to go there, it doesn't happen.
Absolutely right. You have to have enough political pressure to trigger either impeachment proceedings or, as Russ Douthat called for recently, a declaration under the 25th Amendment by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet that the president is unfit in order to trigger some sort of adjudication. And then under the 25th Amendment, 2/3 of Congress would have to agree that he's unfit and remove him. So I think the result of this is that Congress, unlike juries, are less likely to care about the really technical niceties of obstruction and maybe more moved by the shifting explanations and the fact that the real motive behind the firing seemed to have had something to do with shutting down Russia.
It sounds to me, though, that if Trump is just in a kind of firestorm of naivete and a lack of sophistication about what goes on in Washington, that could be some form of a defense. Innocent incompetence?
That's a beautiful way to put it. And as several commentators have noted, in the case of the leak of intelligence to Russia, the innocent incompetent defense, which is that he simply didn't understand the information was classified when he boasted about it, was the real one that they weren't able to make. But innocent incompetence could rise to the level of illegal incompetence if the president publicly states explanations that are false in order to cover up his true motive.
Jeffrey Rosen, as always, thank you for all that help.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Jeffrey Rosen is president of the National Constitution Center and professor of law at George Washington University. Consensus has emerged that the intelligence in question at the White House meeting between President Trump and two senior Russian officials last week came from Israel. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has said no secrets were shared, and he's prepared to hand over transcripts of that meeting if requested by the White House. Israel has long been a valued source of information on what's happening in the Middle East, as well as what's happening inside Russia. Israeli officials won't confirm that any Israeli intelligence was leaked to the Russians, but Israelis are happy to say no damage was done from the leak that they won't discuss. The Israeli ambassador to the United States told The Times, quote, "Israel has full confidence in our intelligence gathering relationship with the United States and looks forward to deepening that relationship in the years ahead under President Trump." President Trump is bound for Israel this weekend as part of his foreign trip. Dr. Anat Wolf is a former member of the Israeli Knesset from 2010 to 2013 and a former Israeli intelligence officer.
The intelligence cooperation between the United States and Israel has been growing steadily in the past few years, to the point that recently it's been considered the deepest, the broadest that it's ever been. Israel has repeatedly demonstrated its ability to provide quality intelligence, certainly on threats in the Middle East, to American interests, and the sharing of intelligence has become more intense in recent years.
Isn't there a bit of a concern, though, that the president would, without warning, share this with the Russians, who are often a source of intelligence? I mean, the Israelis are seen to be a great source of intelligence in the Middle East and Russia. That would be of serious concern, I would think, to Israeli intelligence officials.
So all intelligence agencies always operate with the knowledge that once in a while, and it certainly happened in Israel several times, politicians, leaders will divulge information. They do it for their own interests. If it happens once in a while and it doesn't endanger anything critical, it just happens. The question here, first of all, is this a pattern? Or was this a single slip up? And of course, the question is, how much damage has taken place? Initial reports speak perhaps of an operative, a person who was within the Islamic State. That, of course, would be grave damage, including the possibility of that person himself being ousted, being outed. And other than that, it really remains to be seen how great the damage is and whether the president understands that this is not something that could happen again.
Compared to the Obama administration, there seems to be a lot of satisfaction, shall we say, of the presidency of Donald Trump compared with what happened over the last 8 years. Are you saying that Israelis are inclined to give President Trump some slack here because he seems to be so sympathetic on a range of issues?
No, not because of that. First of all, with all due respect, the United States is a superpower. We're the small country, so we're really, by nature, we give slack to the United States. But more broadly speaking, this is not something that is within Israel's control. We certainly hope that it was a one-time mistake. And beyond that, what we really see is that the United States-Israel relationship under the previous president, under this president, is very strong. I know that people like to personalize the relationship as one between leaders, but at the end of the day, this is a very broad and deep relationship that cuts across issues of security, intelligence, economy, culture, society. So it's never just about the people at the top. It's true that there's a sense that a President Trump is instinctively warm towards Israel, but in terms of what his policies are going to be, I think all Israelis have learned by now that he's unpredictable and it's unclear what his policies are going to be.
Other nations looking at this situation might be inclined to be a little more guarded about and perhaps outraged about what's happened. Part of what's very special about the Israeli relationship with the United States and the Israeli, experience and reputation in intelligence is that, going back well before the Iranian Revolution, I mean, the Israelis had the best intelligence in the Middle East because they were almost uniquely capable of turning all kinds of individuals involved in various organizations that declared that, Israel should never exist, that Israel should be pushed into the sea. And yet there were sources within those organizations that became sources of intelligence for Israel. For such a source to be outed is certain death for that source. And whether the Israelis consider that to be serious or not, I would think every other intelligence agency would consider it pretty serious.
If that is indeed the case, that is very serious. There's no doubt about it. The question is, again, is there an understanding in the United States that this is something that happened by mistake, that it should not happen? The big question is, was this a single slip up with the serious repercussions, or should we be looking at a change in what is happening? I think at the moment, also because of the importance and the depth of the relationship, you see also the declarations coming out of Israeli leaders. The tendency is to say we will move forward as before with an understanding that this is deeply, deeply sensitive, and these are the kinds of things that could not easily happen.
But just to be clear, for an Israeli source within an organization like Hamas or ISIS to be turned and then to be publicly outed, that's a death sentence, right?
Oh, certainly.
Dr. Wilf, it's been great speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Anat Wilf is a former member of the Israeli Knesset from 2010 to 2013 and a former Israeli intelligence officer. Jeffrey Gettleman is a happy man who works in places of unbelievable conflict and misery. His joy comes from being able to find and convey the extraordinary power of the human spirit, regardless of the cruelty it faces in our time. Gettleman is East Africa bureau chief for the New York Times. He dreamt at age 19 of leaving his suburban Chicago upbringing and seeing the world. His first humanitarian trip to Africa in the 90s sealed the deal. But to get a real reporting gig with the Times, he had to make detours in Tampa, Los Angeles, and the Deep South to Iraq and Afghanistan, all while trying to maintain a life, wife, and his dream of a family, children. Gettleman writes about his many loves and his many journeys in a new book, Love Africa, A Memoir of Romance, War, and Survival.
A lot of what I cover is conflict and war and sad, miserable stories. But I feel a responsibility to do that because not that many correspondents are still left in this part of the world. There's only a few big media organizations that are supporting people like my job over there right now. And these African countries are often very tightly controlled with no freedom of the press and no independent journalism. So if I find out about something happening in Rwanda, there was a story I did about all these street children disappearing from the streets of Kigali, the capital. And it ended up that the Rwandan government had set up a prison camp on an island in the middle of a lake. And they were shipping all these young people to this prison camp with no due process, just scooping them up off the streets, putting them in the back of a pickup truck and taking them to this island for 3 years. And when I asked the government, I said, hey, you guys take them to court or is there any kind of process to decide if they should be going to this island? They said, no, these people aren't criminals. And I said, well, are they free to leave? And they said no. And I did a story about this whole phenomenon, and nobody else had done that. And if I hadn't done that, I don't know if the word would have ever gotten out.
Part of the story you tell in this book is the story of how, you know, correspondents fall in love with their mission, and people fall in love with swashbuckling, adventure-seeking correspondents. And this narrative is sort of both the absolute joy and agony of your life trying to reconcile these two. Explain.
Well, I didn't get into the business to be a danger-seeking adventure guy.
Which is, of course, what they all say, but please continue.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, maybe I am sort of an undercover adrenaline junkie, but I wanted to be in Africa first. When I was a young guy, I didn't even know if I wanted to be a journalist. I wasn't focused on that. And I struggled for a while. I was pretty lost, and it was very uncomfortable. Coming out of college, being in graduate school, around all these bright people that seemed to know exactly what they wanted to do, and I felt like an imposter because I didn't know. I didn't have a plan. Once I sort of set my sights on becoming a newspaper correspondent, I did that because I wanted to live and work in Africa. That was my goal. And it was a long route, and it took me through Central Florida. It took me through, you know, California, this deep south, all over, Iraq and Afghanistan. And I did all that because I wanted to live and work in Africa. And then once I got the job, it was like a dream come true because I now had the resources and the excuse to go and explore all these places I'd always been dreaming about, like Congo, like Sudan, like Rwanda and Uganda and all these countries that had their own stories that I had read about that I had never actually experienced. But there's a personal cost because the work is very absorbing. It's at times dangerous. And it's not just about me. So now I have two kids and a wife in Nairobi. And
how did that even happen? How can you meet someone and, you know, make the judgment that actually we're going to be together enough to, number one, be able to have kids, and number two, for a relationship to be sustainable?
Well, my wife and I met when I was very young. We were in college, and she always knew this was something I wanted to do. So even though there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of agony that we put ourselves through trying to make the right decisions about being together, she knew this was something I wanted to do. And when we first moved to Kenya, we traveled together. She's a lawyer, but she took some time off and was filming videos of the stories that I was working on. So it was wonderful. We went to Darfur. We went to Mogadishu. We went to Libya. We went all around the continent.
When have you been a target?
All the time. This is it. Like, this part of the world, they don't like journalists. They don't have respect for what we do, the governments. They see us as a threat because their own people don't have the resources to write the bad stories about them. So we're the ones that are the biggest threat. I was thrown in jail with my wife in Ethiopia for a week early on in my tenure. And I was shocked. Ethiopia is an American ally. They get $1 billion every year from American taxpayers. And they had no qualms whatsoever putting me in jail for a week because they didn't like what I was writing, which at the time was a story about human rights abuse committed by the Ethiopian military. So you're constantly worried about so many different things on every story. You're worried about being kidnapped by bandits. You're worried about getting caught in a crossfire where maybe, you know, there's violence going on around you and nobody's trying to hurt you per se, but it's a violent, chaotic, lawless place. Anything can happen. And then there's this piece of trying to kind of sneak around the government and do your work and do it honorably and avoid the repression that they squeeze down on everybody in their country, and they're trying to do it to you too.
How do you explain to people in Africa what's going on here? Is Donald Trump our Mobutu, our Marcos, our Selassie? Do they understand such a character, or is he just not understandable?
He resembles the African big man more than any other president of the United States ever has. He talks a lot. He's a celebrity. He has a lot of money. He kind of throws his weight around. And that's exactly what these guys are used to seeing. But people now are concerned about the United States because the U.S. plays a huge role in Africa with humanitarian aid, with military assistance. And now that there's talk about changing that, people are very, very concerned because right now there's four famines about to happen across Africa and the Middle East. And if you go to one of these, you know, refugee camps, all over you see these huge bags of food that say donated by the people of the United States, a big bag of sorghum or wheat or beans. And that stuff keeps people alive. So if there's a serious, you know, change in that policy here, it's going to be felt all across Africa.
Finally, your book is called Love Africa, A Memoir of Romance, War, and Survival. Could it also be called The Last Correspondent?
No, I think there's always going to be an appetite for on-the-ground reporting. I think there's always going to be an audience that wants a real experience when they're reading a story, to feel the place, to smell it, to see it, to try to understand it, even if you never go there.
Well, Brother Gettleman, you've done fine, fine work. Congratulations, and may you do much more of it. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Jeffrey Gettleman is the East Africa Bureau Chief for The New York Times. His new book, Love Africa, A Memoir of Romance, War, and Survival, is out now. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The intense focus on Donald Trump and his missteps in Washington may constitute something of a humanitarian disaster in that everything else in the world gets put on hold. Take the brutal civil war in Yemen. To a UN-declared famine, we can now add what authorities are describing as a public health emergency. Hundreds of deaths, thousands of infections due to a major cholera outbreak. Jamie McGoldrick is the UN humanitarian coordinator in Yemen, and he's in the city of Sana'a at the heart of the outbreak.
Because of the conflict and because of the damage to infrastructure and the restrictions on importations, people's purchasing power are really struggling. Bringing in oil, bringing in fuel, gas, medicines, and the fact that you have ministries of health who really struggle with operational budgets, all of that, and including the inflation rate, makes it very, very serious conditions that would find very, very difficult to address the cholera situation and very, very difficult for people to cope with the cholera situation because they can't buy cheap, clean water. The rainy season, there's been no garbage collection for some time now in the city. All of that is coming together in the perfect storm, and the cholera is really, really accelerating in a very aggressive fashion.
Is it the UN's position that this war is, as a matter of strategy, starving out and attempting to use disease as a weapon, the Saudis with the help of the United States in air power? Is that what's going on here?
I mean, what's happened is that the economy has been used as a tactic in this conflict. There's no two ways about it. you know, the restrictions on importation, the move of the central bank to the south of the country, the fact that salaries haven't been paid, the banking sector doesn't work. Importers of bringing in wheat and rice find it very difficult to get lines of credit in the open international market. So all of that has been used to squeeze the population here. And what's happened is now over a period of time, it's like a humanitarian sort of spiral effect going downwards. And then what happened is now that people cannot cope with what's there. You put on top of that the food insecurity and now this famine. This is a double whammy for all the people in this country.
Is there a humanitarian effort to try to resolve this or counterbalance what's going on with the war?
The special envoys are doing the rounds of the various parties in the various parts of the region, including the people here. But at the same time, I mean, from my side, what we're looking at is this long-term stymied stalemate of the political process is only exacerbating the situation for the people in the country. We, the humanitarians right now, have responded to this cholera as we're trying to respond to the 18-plus million people who need assistance. This cholera has come on top of 7 million people who are so unable to predict how they will feed their families tomorrow. The number of beggars in the street, people rummaging through garbage to survive. I mean, this is what's happening. It's a gradual deterioration, collapse of everything here. And unless we get a political process and negotiators back on the table, there is no end in sight for this.
Finally, Jamie McGoldrick, is there a way of saying that the people of Sana'a or the people of Yemen that you speak with, do they have any preference for who might become the political authority in this country?
This country has never been governed well in the last 30 years. That's one of the problems why we're here today in this conflict. It's been a deficit of governance. People don't care until the peace process kicks back in again. Unfortunately, millions of people in this country, untold millions of people in this country, just don't have a future.
Jamie McGoldrick is the UN humanitarian coordinator in Yemen. He's in the city of Sana'a, which is at the heart of the outbreak of cholera and all of the humanitarian suffering that he's described. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you. No problem.
We've been speaking this week about how during the years of government inaction on immigration reform, a system has grown up to house people in a kind of gigantic federal waiting room. This shadow prison system is run by the government agency ICE. In a moment, we will meet an activist who has created hotlines for confused and terrified immigrants to try and get help. Ralph Al-Hassani is a detainee who reached out to the First Friends hotline from inside the Bergen County Jail in New Jersey. First Friends facilitated a conversation between Ralph and one of our producers. A member of the LGBT community from Ghana, where he felt persecuted, Ralph sought asylum in the U.S. in September of 2015 and was taken into custody by ICE in California.
I was in a detention in California called Adelanto Detention Facility. I belong to the LGBT community from Ghana. But unfortunately for me, I didn't have an attorney to represent me before the judge. So most of us who were not able to hire an attorney have to represent ourselves before the judge. When I was released on bond. I was released on a bond of $35,000 from the judge. Properties have to be sold to pay this bond for me. My mom did all this. She had to sell her house because she feared if I get back home, I'll be prosecuted.
Released after 8 months, he was instructed to report to ICE regularly, and Ralph moved east. In the summer of 2016, an officer decided, though, that Ralph should never have been released on bond at all.
But then I was given a form to report, to always report to ICE, and I did report all the time. But then I met an ICE officer whom I explained my situation to, because he was wondering how I was released, but then had to report all the time. So I told him I was given a bond of $35,000 by the judge. So he was like, no, it's not supposed to be that way. So he asked me to come back in January 2017. But then on the 12th of August 2016, I said they wanted to see me on the 15th of August 2016. So on the 15th when I went, they said they were going to cancel the bond and detain me because my case was not appealed.
And since then, Ralph has been in detention in New Jersey.
After I spent 8 months in California, I spent another 9 months and I'm in New Jersey right now. So I don't really know what is happening. All I know is ICE is trying to deport me now because on the 10th of February, they made me speak with my consulate about my travel document. I'm not having the money back, and now ICE is also trying to deport me back to my country to face prosecution.
Ralph Al-Hassani describes his life in immigration detention, and you can hear in his voice that his hope and patience are running out.
We get up at
Jail administration will disconnect your call in 3 minutes.
We get up at 8:30 or sometimes 8 o'clock in the morning. We have our breakfast, then that's it. We need to move around till it is 12 o'clock. They put us back in the jail, they lock us up and open us up again to come to eat, and then they put you in at 9 o'clock and lock you up again. It is hell, my brother. We've been treated like prisoners. There is no life here. There is no life. For the past 9 months, they lock us up.
The jail administration will disconnect your call in 2 minutes.
You have to be locked up during count. You have to be locked up when about to eat. And you have to be locked up when you're going to sleep. I want people out there to know that immigration detention is not a good thing at all. ICE is not treating us with justice. Because if I have been allowed to pay bond and then come out of detention, why should I be detained again? Why should I be detained? I know United States believes in justice. The whole world, everybody knows that. And then after coming all the way from my country to this country to have my freedom, I've been treated like this. I don't think this is fair. So if there is anything people could do to help people like me in my situation...
The jail administration will disconnect your call in 1 minute.
I would be most grateful. That is my message.
And we should note that Ralph Al-Hassani has committed no crime, even though he spent $35,000 and has spent months in ICE detention. Sally Pillay is the director of First Friends. She's the activist who manages free hotlines for people in immigration detention to call and seek support or just to have someone to talk to. It was Sally Pillay who put us in touch with Ralph, and she also connected us with Yanet Candelario Salazar, whose case is very different. She has dual Canadian-Cuban citizenship. When she was stopped by ICE, she was held initially in the Elizabeth Detention Center in New Jersey, then transferred to the Orange County Correctional Facility in New York, where she's mixed with the inmate population, even though she has a green card pending and has committed no crime. We spoke to her from inside the Orange County facility. Her line is difficult to understand, but she was happy to tell us what it's like inside the ICE netherworld.
I am in a dorm with about 50 beds. About half of the inmates here are people in criminal convictions or waiting to be convicted. I have adjusted to the lack of any freedom. The human rights abuses that I've seen in there are unbelievable. The things that I've seen in here, I mean, I was at the detention where they had a woman who was 82 years old and very frail, detained for like 3 weeks. They had a pregnant woman that they claim, I told First Friends that she was detained and they called ICE. They were not happy that First Friends knew that they had a pregnant woman.
You have 1 minute remaining.
We asked Sally Pillay to talk about Yanet's case and the difficulties of getting out of immigration detention once you're put in.
I mean, we get different stories in different days. Sometimes it's heart-tugging and, you know, I have tears in my eyes with some of the stories that individuals will share with us. But in particular, you know, recently we've been getting a lot of calls about how people are being picked up in the communities, apprehended, especially when they go to ICE reportings, to ICE check-ins, and then are being re-detained or are just, you know, being picked up on random, like, traffic violations where ICE is present at courts, just rounding up immigrants to be placed in immigration detention. So it changes from day to day, but this is some of the scenarios of people apprehended and being picked up.
Why do you think Yanet Candelario Salazar reached out to you?
She reached out to us because, one, we do have the hotlines that are present in all of the detention facilities. We are able to transfer and link her to calls to her lawyer, to the community, to her family. She has an 18-year-old son who she is an integral support for him and does not have the ability to get that.
And if you listen to her, in her voice, it sounds like she has a case that she's going to win here.
On May 11 this year, I left the country for 3 days, and I had a green card application pending. They detained me and charged me as an arriving alien. They didn't know what to charge me with because I was Cuban and Canadian. I requested a bond hearing, but the local judge said he had no jurisdiction to give me bond, so I requested the federal court to grant me a bond hearing. I'm waiting until the 22nd. Hopefully, it will be granted. My attorney believes it's going to be granted. I hope I do. I had lost so much. I mean, 8 months of my life.
So Yana here is giving a sophisticated argument legally about why she shouldn't be where she is. She has a green card pending. She has all the things that you would suspect would put her on the outside of this dragnet, not on the inside of this dragnet. She has family issues that she describes here. Yet she, from your perspective, can't be guaranteed of a successful outcome.
Unfortunately, no. And she is one of many individuals in the same plight who should not be placed in immigration detention and should be used as a last resort.
And her experience these 8 months looking at what's inside of this facility, you can see that it even takes a toll on her sense of hope for her own story.
I couldn't begin to imagine, and even when I got here, I thought this was a mistake, and they were going to release me shortly. It is unbelievable. I still cannot believe that I thought I would be here for a few weeks and a month. I have lost any money that I have. I mean, the weight of my child, that, you know, his grades have suffered, and he's been on his own all this time.
It was devastating to listen to that call, knowing that she is in distress, not having a son by her side.
How much of what she's describing is the result of just a kind of confused legal situation that she really has no idea what's next in the process that might even actually get her released?
Definitely. It's a limbo state that everyone is in because they just don't know what's going to happen next. And every situation is so unique to an individual. The judge may rule differently for each one. Even they may present similar cases. We've gotten a lot of calls from people. They felt that if they just stayed languishing in detention, that they, at the end, would result in a negative outcome regardless of just battling this out, just the sense of fear, retaliation, not knowing what's going to happen next.
I think that the ICE officers at the Elizabeth Detention Center, they are used to immigrants who do not speak the language. People are afraid to speak because they think it will affect their case. And so when they come across somebody like me who speaks the language and is not afraid to speak, they retaliate against you. I antagonize a machine that is a lot stronger than me.
Hope is gone?
It's a sense of hope that's gone, yeah. Honestly, it's difficult because we don't know what would happen next. But, you know, we do know that things are amplified under this administration. We do know that there's been a lot of ICE raids. I mean, literally about 1,000 feet from our office space, there was a raid about a week ago where 40 people were rounded up. So we know that, you know, there's going to be a lot of internal enforcement happening. Individuals are going to be rounded up. Immigration detention is going to continue to rise and grow. To what end, I don't know. Definitely we need policies and reforms that are just and humane. Definitely right now that is not the case. And we do want to see an end to immigration detention. We want to see it being used as a last resort, not for the people like Yaneth and Ralph to be re-detained because it's all ending up because of the money. It's a dragnet of private prisons are making money and county jails that are making money out of human suffering. Once you get in, it's absolutely difficult to break out once you're funneled into immigration detention.
Sally Pillay is the director of First Friends, an activist organization dealing with immigration detention. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And finally today, is all this in Washington a government shutdown? It kind of feels that way. What's not getting done that you would like to see addressed?
This is Nancy Holcomb calling from Seattle, Washington. My first priority is to carefully vet the person selected for approval as the new head of the census. Census data is going to be critical in fairly assigning congressional districts and positions in the future. So the person selected has to be nonpartisan, competent, and adequately funded.
From Oviedo, Florida, the Democrats need to stop blocking everything the president tries to do to help this country. What do you want Congress to get to? Let us know, 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.